Soon after he boarded the light rail at the downtown station, Bredigan checked the available space, saw two empty seats next to each other at the far end of the car, and aimed himself in their direction as the doors chimed shut. Having taken the one on the aisle, he removed his Minnesota Twins baseball cap and placed it beside him so that no one would drop down there. An odd, soapy purple light, the translucent advertising sheath attached to the outside of the car was filtering the sun, gave his hands a bruised discoloration as if he had been in a fistfight. A young couple followed him onto the train and sat down in the seats opposite his own. A man of retirement age, Bredigan wore an expression of studied neutrality whenever he found himself in public, as if he possessed important secret information and needed to fade into the background to avoid exposure. Despite his age, he still had a full head of graying hair, rather bushy eyebrows, and penetrating blue eyes. Deep lines creased his face, though he wore khakis and a cotton sports shirt, giving an appearance of informality. He sat as straight as a child who had recently been told not to slouch, and he gazed out the window with the uneasy intelligence of someone who has few illusions to comfort him. Last week on this commuter train, there had been an incident. A woman whose baby was in a stroller had pitched and rolled her way to a seat directly in front of him. Bredigan had been close to the window, near enough to hear her panting. From time to time, she had uttered soft groans. Every few seconds, she would nod and say, uh-huh, as if in conversation with a ghost companion. When an old man had walked past and leaned down to pat her stroller-bound infant on the head, the woman had started to shout, "Don't you touch my baby," she said, pointing at the aging passenger who, alarmed, hurried out the doors at the train's next stop. Then she had glared at Bredigan, still sitting there behind her, as if he too were guilty of public touching. Collecting himself, Bredigan had pretended to stare at the landscape outside. Where he looked apparently didn't matter. "Nobody touches my baby," she cried, suddenly in Bredigan's direction. She smelled of wine. Her baby probably smelled of wine. The whole car smelled of wine and beer and Red Bull. But this morning, the train had apparently been steam cleaned, and the usual professional managerial types, suited, accessorized, and iPhoned, were seated nearby, tapping out messages, talking into their Bluetooths, or reading the Wall Street Journal. Very few victims of capitalism were on the train today. Most people thought of them as the homeless, or as vagrants, or the deinstitutionalized mad. One of Bredigan's friends preferred to call them scum. But for Bredigan, they were the victims of capitalism, that generously proportioned sector of the economy that had never had a single foothold on the ladder of success and who were lying on the ground anywhere they could fall unmolested. In midsummer, you'd find them on the train rumbling out to the Mall of America, a terminal point where they would not disembark but stay right where they were, collapsed in heaps, half asleep and therefore semi-alert until the train started up again and returned to downtown Minneapolis. They had no purchases. They consumed nothing but air and food scraps. Even the tattered clothes they wore seemed borrowed from somewhere. Back and forth the trains would go, carrying their half-awake human freight. Whenever Bredigan exchanged glances with one of these people, he tried to make his face express compassion and kindliness. They looked back at him with sodden indifference or hatred. Every once or so often, one of the victims of capitalism awakened and weighed down with God would start to shout inspired prophecy. "Look at my wounds," someone had loudly commanded last week, without specifying any location. And then, Where's Duluth?